Right, we're ready to go, Sadhana.
All right, wonderful. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the May 2020 board meeting of the Oregon First. This is Sadhana Shenoy, and I would like the other board members to please announce themselves.
Steve Buckley.
Lawrence Fernstall.
We've got Lawrence, we've got Steve, we've got Jardon, and we've got the other Steve. So, good. All on board. Thank you. Before we jump into the agenda, I do want to send greetings from this board to the employees and staff of FIRST, and I do hope that everyone is staying healthy and keeping safe. So with that, our first item is the board meeting minutes from March 30th, 2020. Any questions or comments on the minutes as presented? If not, then do I hear a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any nays? Okay, so moved. Next, we had a supplementary board meeting on April 24th, and the minutes of that meeting are also presented. Questions, comments on those minutes? If not, then do I hear a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved.
Okay.
Second.
Right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any nays? Thank you. So moved. Okay, I invite Director Lennick to present the director's report. Kevin?
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, Vice Chair Fernstall, board members. For the record, Kevin Olenek, Director Kurz. And welcome to the May 29th board meeting via teleconferencing. We're obviously still meeting this way as a result of the agency's efforts to work through COVID-19 challenges and continuing as best possible to maintain operations. For board members, a quick reminder to please identify yourself when you're speaking or moving a motion so that we can reflect that accurately in the minutes. As always, we have a very interesting agenda to work through this morning. For the director's report piece, again, a summary of items that the board should be aware of and a few items to note within the report. First off, with respect to COVID-19, a big thanks to our incident response team, which is meeting regularly to discuss the impacts of COVID. And we're now actually moving from responding to the incident to shifting to how we may transition back as the state reopens in phases. A shout out to all our staff who are showing great resilience and productivity. At this time, we have 3/4 of our staff working from home, with the remainder working on site with appropriate social distancing. And we continue to do not only our daily operational work, but also Senate Bill 1049 implementation efforts. And I'm extremely proud of the staff in being as resilient and productive as they have been. One other consequential item arising from shutting down the state these past few months is the impact of the state's revenues. A revenue forecast came out on May 20th, and there's an anticipated $1.8 billion shortfall for this biennium. As you may be aware, the governor has asked general fund agencies to propose budget allotment reductions to help make up this shortfall. It should be noted that PERS is an other fund agency and that operationally we are funded through the PERS trust. However, we did receive $100 million from the general fund for the employer incentive fund in the 1921 biennium budget, and the agency was requested to put forth a proposed reduction to the EIF to comply with the governor's request. We, as well as other agencies, have not received any word on next steps, but there is a distinct possibility that we may see a reduction to the employer incentive fund. And we'll probably know by the end of June if that is to take place. With respect to the forward-looking calendar, we have included proposed dates for the 2021 meetings. I believe these dates are now pretty solid, so let us know if that is not the case. As well, we've scheduled one special meeting so that we can deal with administrative rulemaking arising from the Senate Bill 1049 implementation on a timely basis. The next one is Tuesday, June 23rd at 9 a.m. Again, this will be held via teleconference and should be relatively short in duration. With respect to the Oak Perf investment report, we just sent out the April returns on Tuesday, and they show year-to-date regular account earnings of minus 5.04, an improvement from the negative 7.24 from March, and May seems to be following the upward trend, as was the case in April. Budget execution report, we're still at 38% of our legislatively adopted operations budget, with a positive variance projected right now of 500,000 approximately. Matt Rickard will present the board scorecard report for the period ending March 31st, and then Stephanie will be going through numerous administrative rulemaking items. I believe there's five on the agenda today. Following Stephanie will be Karen Chavez, who will be presenting for board approval the PHIP reserve policy, and then additionally, Karen will be presenting for board approval the 2021 retiree health insurance plan renewals and rates for adoption. Item C3, we'll be talking about the proposed board education policy. As a note, it was presented and discussed at the March Audit Committee meeting. Following that, Yvette will report out on our progress on implementing Senate Bill 1049. And item C5, Richard will provide an update to the board on the agency's 21-23 budget development. And item C6, Milliman will be presenting for discussion a letter setting out the different approaches and respective pros and cons to the two actual smoothing methods, one being asset smoothing and the other being our current adopted rate coloring approach. And from that, the board and Milliman can then discuss next steps. Lastly, I'd like to formally welcome Heather Case, our new senior policy advisor to PERS. I'm sure the board will be interacting with Heather on a regular basis. And that concludes my director's report, unless there are questions arising from it. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. One quick question. Outside of the $100 million EIF money, is there any other area at all that you feel you might have to incorporate some cuts?
I would, Chair Shenoy, good question. I would expect that as the governor and or if there is a special session called, there might be a requirement for PERS to follow sort of consistently with other state agencies what they're doing with respect to some cuts. So on that point, we have identified some areas where we might be able to defer spending, be it some deferred maintenance and some other improvements we had planned to make. And we're also taking a look at some of our vacancies and seeing if we could slow down going after the recruitments on those positions to make sure that we follow the spirit and intent of what other agencies are going through at this time.
Okay, all right. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Then we can invite Matt Rickard to present the board scorecard, please.
Thank you. Chair Shenoy, members of the board, for the record, this is Matt Rickard, Central Data Coordinator, and I'm representing PERS Outcome-Based Management System Council. I'm here to share with you our semi-annual board scorecard report that highlights a key selection of measures from our agency-level scorecards. This report covers performance during the first quarter of 2020, and I want to share a few of the highlights and key takeaways. The two charts at the top of the board scorecard do reflect performance over our entire set of 65 active enterprise measures. The pie chart displays a breakdown of measures performing in the green, yellow, and red ranges. Green is at or approaching target of performance, yellow is lagging behind, and red is further behind that target of performance. This chart reflects 31 measures in that desired green range, with 14 and 20 measures in the yellow and red ranges, respectively. The quarterly green performance chart displays the percent of the measures quarter by quarter over the last year that have performed in that green range. The 48% that we hit this quarter is a decrease from the 57% we were at last quarter. So the overall current performance reflects a drop from where we were at throughout 2019 and that is at least partly attributable to staff shortages resulting from Senate Bill 1049 project work. So looking at the selection of measures that are highlighted on the board scorecard, we do see some indication of this decreased performance, though there are some positives as well. We've had four straight quarters in the green ranges for both eligibility reviews and accuracy of calculations, and we've had three out of four quarters in that green range for recruiting onboarding. We also have a positive or even trend for four of those eight measures. And the next board scorecard report will be presented at our December 4th, 2020 board meeting, and that will cover results for the third quarter of 2020. So that's the scorecard summary I have for you today. Can I help with any questions or comments from the board?
Well, I always have comments, but is there any other board member that would like to? Okay. I'll go then, Matt. I'm looking at OP3C, and this is the estimate KPM measure. And this measure has been red since Q1 of 2019, and pretty much has been down. In fact, except for a quarter or two in 2018, it has pretty much always been in the red zone. And similarly for OP5C, so I guess my overall question, and this is a question to Kevin as well as to Matt, is since we are seeing these persistent areas of red and poor performance, either the targets that we've set are sort of unachievable, or then maybe we need more staffing. Kevin, can you talk to that a little bit, please?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Shenoy. You're correct. There are some of these measures that we struggle to hit on a consistent basis. So a few things that we're doing is, one, taking a look at the measure itself. Some of these measures haven't been changed since these measures were adopted approximately 8 years ago. And so we've challenged the management team to look at them and say, do they really reflect what we're capable of doing? And if not, what is something that is challenging yet achievable? And so over this past while, we have changed probably about a half dozen of these measures, and we'll continue to review them. We're also taking a look at some of the underlying processes that support these to see if there are ways of making improvements. I think we had some of these were being sort of scheduled to look at, but then 1049 came along and we've moved a lot of staff over to the implementation of that, and then they're using backfills to support operational requirements. So it's a bit of a balancing act, but not to throw that out as an excuse, it's just a statement of fact. But to the point of what are we going to be doing, we are looking at adding some additional staff in the 21-23 budget request to enhance our current service level staffing, and as well making sure that the measures that we look at are reflective of what our staff are capable of, given both the processes and the underlying support systems that we have in place.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I look forward then in December to hearing what changes the agency has come up with. So thank you for that. Any other questions? All right. Then we can move on to Stephanie Vaughn. And Every board meeting just indicates the incredible complexity of SB 1049 and how much and how hard staff have to work to implement all that. So kudos to everyone. Stephanie, take it away.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, Stephanie Vaughn with PERS. Yes, we have a lot of rules today. Starting with item B1 is notice of the voluntary contributions rule. The member redirect portion of Senate Bill 1049 allows members to elect to make additional contributions to the regular IEP account such that a full 6% of their salary is deposited into their regular IEP account. This new rule outlines how PERS will administer those contributions. This is a new concept for PERS, and it requires a lot of development of new processes, system changes, programming. And while we made every effort to implement this provision as of the effective date of July 1, 2020, staff is anticipating implementing this in September of 2020. But as noted in the draft rule and in the memo, members will have the opportunity to make retroactive contributions back to the 7/1/2020 effective date when we do turn it on or implement it. Staff have been working with stakeholders, specifically employers, as we work through the implementation process and how we will be building the processes. And the employers have expressed some concerns with some of these processes. Specifically, the biggest one is the retroactive nature of the contributions. Because the members are only eligible to make these contributions when their IEP contributions are redirected to the Employee Pension Stability Act or account, the provisions such as they have to make a certain amount of money, so in the month, so the threshold is $2,500 a month. And some members have fluctuating salaries, so PERS needs to determine their eligibility month to month as we go through. And if they are eligible to make the contributions, we will be invoicing the member, the employers, retroactively. So we will be invoicing them the month after for the contributions for the prior month. And this causes a concern for employers such that if the employee leaves or the they have to turn it on or off month to month. Also, another concern that they've raised is retroactive contributions that are triggered by account adjustments. So we could be talking years down the line where there's a correction to member data that causes a change in the contributions, and the employers then are required to collect these contributions, and the member again could have terminated employment with that particular employer. We've tried to address these concerns as much as we can through our implementation and building these processes. To help address the retroactive invoicing issue, we've incorporated into the rule the requirement that once the employer is notified that the member has made an election, the employer should be withholding those contributions immediately. They should not be waiting for the invoice so that they are not collecting the contributions retroactively. They will actually be collecting them in real time from the employees. And then if the employee does not meet the eligibility standards, then the employer would refund those contributions back to the member. With regard to retroactivity, we're really trying to reduce the incidence of retroactive contributions, with the exception of the ability to make those retroactive contributions off the bat back to July 1, 2020. Elections will be prospective only, with that one exception. And we've narrowed that window down, the window to make those contributions back to July 1st, 2020. They will have only 1 month to elect to make the retroactive contributions. And those contributions need to be made by the end of the year as well, I think. We are also examining other options as far as the retroactive contributions that are triggered by account adjustments. We're evaluating and examining other options and possibilities that we might be able to implement to help address those concerns or at least reduce the incidence as much as we can. Implementation is still in process, and we will continue to work with employers on those points. This is notice only of the rule. We are continuing implementation, so likely that there will be changes before we bring it forward for adoption in July, but no action is required at this time. Does anybody have any questions?
Stephanie, go ahead.
Stephanie, this is Steve Buckley. putting aside the retroactivity issue for a moment, is there anything in this administrative rule or another administrative rule that discusses the amount of time an employer has to remit employee contributions after that money has been withheld from the employee's wages?
We do have requirements as far as timing. We do. Mm-hmm. I don't know off the top of my head what rule it is, but there is a rule out there that, and actually statute, allows us to charge the employer's interest on late reporting. We don't currently do that, but there is a rule that does provide for a time frame and for penalties if they don't meet those timelines.
Okay. Well, that's good, because I know in the private sector context, the Department of Labor and Internal Revenue Service are very vigilant to make sure that employers remit employee elective contributions to pension plans in a timely manner.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Good. This is a sad story. My question, Stephanie, is about why and how eligibility is determined on a month-to-month basis. And I understand that members have changing salaries. Can you elaborate on that just a bit and give us how often that happens?
Sure. Chair Shinoy, the most common incidence of somebody who's going to have a fluctuating salary is probably substitute teachers. The issue with determining eligibility is also raised. These are actually, as I'm thinking about this, I think we address these in the member redirect rules specifically, because that's where the eligibility is going to be determined. For the voluntary contributions, really the only eligibility is whether the contributions are redirected to the EPSA. But for the $2,500 a month, that includes all the salary that the member earns from all participating employers in the month. So if they're working concurrently for multiple employers, one employer is not going to know if that meets the $2,500, which is why PERS has to make that determination as far as their eligibility, and then retroactively or after the fact let the employers know. So any employee who has fluctuating hours, such as a substitute teacher, their salary can fluctuate from month to month. Timely employer reporting will be critical to this issue as well.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Sure. Any other questions? Okay, I'll move on to item B2, which is temporary adoption and notice of permanent rulemaking for rules implementing the CARES Act. And I'd like to just kind of off the bat point out a couple of things. We're doing temporary rules for these particular rules because we want these provisions to be effective immediately. And while we are implementing COVID-related provisions in our COVID rule, and these provisions that are discussed in this memo are related to COVID, a temporary rule is only effective for 180 days, and the provisions that we are talking about here will be effective and affect the plan for longer than 180 days and potentially for a number of years in the future. So this is why we are putting these provisions in the permanent rules and working through the permanent rulemaking process as well. Also, I'd like to note that these are all OSGP rules, and we did evaluate the CARES Act with regard to OSGP and PERS. And as we worked through that evaluation, it turns out that none of the provisions of the CARES Act actually affect the PERS plan. So the provisions that we're talking about here and these amendments are specific to required minimum distributions, which the CARES Act only suspends for defined contribution plans. And PERS is a defined benefit plan, so that is not going to be suspended for the PERS plan. And the PERS plan does not have a loan program. So you will not be seeing any amendments to rules to implement any of the provisions of the CARES Act for PERS. And lastly, while we had this rule open, there's another federal act that was passed in December that amends provisions of the plan, specifically again with regard to required minimum distributions currently or previously. The age at which a member had to start taking distributions was 70 and a half. The SECURE Act raised that to 72, and while we have these rules open, and these are the exact rules that would need to be amended for that, we've made those amendments as well. With regard to the CARES Act, there's two mandatory provisions that the rules implement. The first is the suspension of the required minimum distributions for calendar year 2020. So members, while they're not required to take distributions, they are still able to take distributions. So we are automatically suspending those. And a one-year delay in loan repayments. So any payment, any loan payments that are due through to December of this year will be delayed for 1 year until next year. There's also one optional provision that we presented as a policy decision for the board, or a policy consideration for the board, and that is to allow in-service distributions. Normally, under federal law, a member must be separated from all employment in order to be able to take a distribution from a retirement plan. And when a distribution is made while a participant is still employed, that is referred to as an in-service distribution. So normally under federal law, those are not allowed. However, the CARES Act is allowing in-service distributions specifically for calendar year 2020. Staff is recommending implementation of this particular optional provision. We also took it to our executive leadership team, and they also support implementation of this provision. And the provision allows, it does have a limit, it's only up to $100,000, and it provides the option for the member to redeposit the distribution into any retirement vehicle within 3 years. So this provision is actually more advantageous for members than if they were to take a loan, which would charge them interest on the amount. So we've drafted the rule with the provision included, and unless otherwise instructed, we will proceed with it included. Are there any questions?
Stephanie, are you and is staff very clear about what specifically impacted by COVID-19 means?
The CARES Act actually defines that.
Okay.
There are three, and I think we actually put it in the rule. We put the language in the rule. So
yeah.
If they're actually have it themselves or have a family member, or I forget what the third one is, but our third-party administrator, Voya, it will be handling the certification, and basically members will be allowed to self-certify if they meet those requirements.
This is Steve Demarest. Stephanie, do these federal provisions for RMDs and in-service distributions apply to the IAP accounts?
Board Member Demarest, actually, no, they do not. We did a lot of evaluation regarding that, and the IAP is not a standalone defined contribution plan. It is treated under, it's a separate account qualified under the plan under 414K, and under that code provision, it is treated like a defined contribution only for specific circumstances such as IRC 415 testing and for how distributions under Section 72 are handled. So we went back and forth on that one, and we landed on that it does not apply to the IAP.
Oh, interesting. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. That was a good question, Member Demarest. Any other comments by board members? Okay, go ahead.
Okay. We are seeking a motion to adopt the rule as presented for the temporary rule.
So moved. Steve Demarest.
Second.
Second, Lauren.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any nays?
Thank you. And, so we do anticipate bringing the permanent rules for adoption at the July board meeting for these rules. All right. So on to item B3, which is another temporary rule. This is our COVID rule. We adopted this rule at the April board meeting, and we're bringing it forward to add another provision. We have not amended or made any changes to the existing provision regarding the health insurance program. We have added a provision for the employee incentive fund program. Excuse me. Currently, we have an application cycle open for the EIF, Employee Incentive Fund, and that cycle is scheduled to close August 31st. Given the current economic environment, staff is recommending extending that cycle to December 1st, which will allow employers to better evaluate their financial circumstances and positions and ability to make those payments. We have made no other changes to the program, so this is not an automatic. We're not automatically moving those payment dates out. Any employer who wants to extend their payment date or push their payment date out will still need to follow the current process to do that, and basically they just notify us and let us know what that new date is. That's all. Are there any questions?
Have any agencies particularly approached you for an extension?
I think there have been employers that have mentioned it. They have concerns about their revenues, their revenue stream. There's been one employer that actually has mentioned they'd like to have it moved out further than December 1st. We've also received at least one comment that I know of from an employer on the wait list who would recommend not moving it out. which we kind of anticipated as far as the individuals on the wait list might have an issue. And the benefit of technology while you're in the board meeting, Mary Michelle Sosny just let me know through instant message that there are several employers who are requesting this.
Okay.
So requesting
Thank you, Mary Michelle.
Thank you, Mary Michelle, yes.
Okay. And also, given the fact that the $100 million allocated to the EIF might be questioned, this is all up in the air. But, this is just extending goodwill to the employers, and certainly I appreciate that.
Yes. Okay.
Any questions from board?
This is Lawrence. I'd just like to add, just echo that the economic impact of COVID-19 and the recession is a very rapidly moving target, and every week we learn more, certainly, and by an extra month or two, we'll learn a lot more. So I think this is a good move, helpful move for us.
Great. Okay, do I
hear
a motion to pass this temporary rule?
This is Stephen Buckley. I've moved to adopt the temporary COVID-19 mitigation rule as presented.
Second.
Okay. Stephen. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any nays? Okay, so moved.
Thank you. All right. Item B4 is adoption of the annual limitation rule. These are amendments that we do every year. We update the salary and contribution limits to bring them in line with the federal limits. We have made one change to one of the rules since notice. We added a definition for account balance in the IAP installments rule, And we've done that here because that is a rule that would have been included in the member redirect package as a minor amendment, but it was already open, so we made that change here. So it's just for clarification. And we've received no public comment on the rule since notice, but we're seeking a motion to adopt the rule as presented.
And this is basically bringing us in line with the IRC changes for 2020.
That's correct, Chair Shinoy. Yes.
Steve Demarest, so moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
So moved.
Excellent. And finally, item B5 is adoption of the member choice rule. So the amendments to this rule implement the member choice provisions of Senate Bill 1049. Currently, members' regular IEP accounts are invested in target date funds based on their year of birth. The member choice provision of Senate Bill 1049 allows members to choose a different target-based fund based on their risk tolerance. So this is effective. This provision is effective January 1, but we will be implementing and starting to receive those elections. We have to receive them this year in order to make those elections effective January 1. We have made a change, a couple of changes to the rule since notice. Again, we have added a definition of IAP account to the rule. Again, this is for clarification regarding member redirect and to clarify the distinction between IAP and the EPSA. We've also added the word and new contributions as recommended by Board Member Demarest at notice. We received no public comment, so we're seeking a motion to adopt the rule or the rule as presented.
Steve Demarest, so moved. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was just making the motion.
Okay.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any nays? Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Next item is Karen Chavez for the First Health Insurance Reserve Policy.
Good morning, Chair Shinoy and members of the board.
Excuse me. I'm sorry,
yeah.
Karen.
No worries.
Chair Shinoy, this is Lawrence Bernstall. Because my employer, OHSU, although it does not own any of these health plans, has contractual relationships with all of them, I'm going to step out of the meeting for these two items and then come back when they're done. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that. And Katie, would you please send a message to Director Bernstall when we are done with these two items? Thank you. Go ahead, Karen Chavez.
Great. Thank you very much. Good morning. Chair Shinoy, members of the board, for the record, I'm Karen Chavez, the PERS Health Insurance Program Manager. And today on item C1, I am seeking approval of the PERS Health Insurance Program Reserve 9-year drawdown model beginning January 1st of 2021. In March, we presented a proposed PHIP reserves conceptual design outlining the PHIP reserves that have been built over time to satisfy contractual requirements. PHIP no longer requires the same level of reserves due to changes with our health insurance contracts. Three conceptual drawdown models were presented in March outlining PHIP member rate credits over a period of 7, 9, or 11 years, primarily intended to smooth out and minimize rate shock resulting from the final spend down of unrestricted reserves. The proposal addressed how reserve amounts in excess of the contractually required amounts would be reviewed annually to determine if a portion of the excess reserves should be used to subsidize rates during the annual rate setting process and subject to the approval of the PERS board. After discussion, The PERS board preferred the nine-year drawdown model and directed staff to make a final recommendation as to the most appropriate drawdown period. After further discussion, PHIP staff is recommending the nine-year drawdown model approach for the following reasons. It allows for a longer, less volatile rate impact from year to year. It allows for a smoother transition to the final year when there are no reserve funds available to subsidize rates. It also allows for greater flexibility in dealing with unanticipated events, and COVID-19 is a very good example of this. As PERS is poised to finalize calendar year 2021 rates, there's uncertainty as to the short and long-term impacts of the virus. And although Oregon appears to have not been as heavily impacted as other states, that could change. The PERS population is the most vulnerable to experiencing significant impacts of the virus. So PHIP staff is recommending no further changes to the conceptual design presented at the March 30th, 2020 meeting. The board options at this point are the board may approve the nine-year PHIP reserve drawdown recommendation beginning January 1, 2021, or direct us to make additional other changes or other options. And at this time, I'm recommending the board choose option one.
Great. Thank you, Karen. I believe there was some pretty robust conversation around this at the March meeting. Is there anything else that board members would like to add? Okay. In that case, do I hear a motion to approve the as presented?
Stephen Buckley, I'd make a motion to approve the nine-year PERS Health Insurance Program Reserve Drawdown beginning January 1, 2021.
Thank you.
Steve Demarest, second. Steve Demarest, second.
Okay. All in favor? Aye.
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 And in aid? Thank you. So moved. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you. I'm also up, it looks like, for item number C2. So if I can just move on to that. I'm also seeking approval for the 2021 retiree health insurance plan renewals and rates for the benefit year 2021. First, I'd like to thank program staff, our consultants, and the contracted health plans for all the hard work that went into achieving the success of the 2021 renewal process. It is particularly impressive because all of our meetings were conducted via online tools and required quite a lot of coordination on everyone's part, so my great appreciation to everyone. As illustrated in the memo, the PERS Health Insurance Program had many items to consider in this year's renewal process. Consideration was given to the elimination of the Affordable Care Act's health insurance tax, which was effective January 1, 2021, and that did impact some CHPs, or contracted health plans, excuse me. The growing short and long-term uncertainty regarding COVID-19 was considered, as well as plan design and benefit improvements in response to member services interactions with PHIP members and the implementation of the proposed reserve drawdown policy. Based on the information we received from PHIP members, our CHPs and the analysis of state and federal trends, there were two primary benefit focus areas for this 2021 renewal. The first one was the inclusion of additional benefits that offer value and address perceived deficiencies by PHIP members, and pharmacy benefit modifications that would retain the actuarial equivalence of the above the standard Medicare Part D benefit and modernize and create a market competitive benefit structure with the potential to increase member adherence and decrease member cost. The PERS Health Insurance Program asked our five carrier partners, CHPs, to present rates for the 2021 benefit plan changes, including adding a vision package to the MOTA supplement plan, which makes it more equivalent to the benefits provided by other Medicare plans, and a vision benefit to the Kaiser non-Medicare plan. The introduction of a five-tiered pharmacy design, including co-pays for those Medicare and non-Medicare plans that were able to do so, and making no changes to the dental plan at this time, and also the elimination of the ACA tax. The rates for the benefits we settled on were included in attachment one to this memo. Additionally, the recommended rates that are on that attachment include the rate credits outlined in the proposed PHIP reserves design based on the adoption of the 9-year drawdown option. The rate credits are consistent with the guidelines provided in the document and range from 0 to 5%. At this time, I am seeking the board to either pass a motion to approve the proposed PHIP renewals benefits rates for the proposed 2021 plan year as presented in item C2, the attachment 1, 2021 proposed rates, which assumes a 9-year drawdown, or direct staff to make changes to these terms or to explore other options. At this time, I'm recommending that the board approve option 1 as presented.
Thank you, Karen. I would, you thank your staff and everybody else. I would like to thank you for the clarity and efficiency you've brought to this process. Also, Member Demarest, who has participated in this decision making, would you like, are there any comments that you would like to share with the board?
Just to reinforce and reiterate what Chair Shenoy just said, I'm continually impressed by the work of PERS staff and the PERS contractors and their work that they put into what ultimately results in the proposal that's coming before the board. And I really appreciate the service they provide to PERS members with their work. Thank you.
With that, if there are no further questions, is there an interest in moving?
This is Steve Demarest. I move that the board approve option 1 as presented.
Second.
Wonderful. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any nays? Good. So moved. Thank you very much, Karen.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Katie, before we move on to the next item, can we have a director install back?
Yeah, Chair Shenoy, Kevin here. I just texted him, so he should be joining shortly.
This is Lawrence Bernstall coming back in.
Wonderful. Okay, so the next item we have is the board education policy presented by Director Olenek.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy. And this is a follow-up to a discussion we had at our December board meeting. If you recall, I brought a board assessment, a governance assessment based on the NCPERS governance framework. And there were two items that were identified as being some gaps in some of our governance framework. One was a board education policy. The second was a board funding policy. So at the March audit committee meeting, I brought a draft board education policy for review and consideration, and the audit committee looked at it and were positive feedback on it. And consequently, we're bringing it today to the full board for review and adoption. A couple points to make is that as far as the board education policy itself, the first and foremost piece of board education is the board orientation manual, which we put together 2 years ago and update. And whenever a new board member joins, we make sure that they're aware of that. And then the education policy itself talks to the fact that board members should self-identify as to which areas of a pension plan administration that they believe they might need to enhance their learnings and capacity on. And what I'll be doing is the director is providing information on available conferences and seminars that I believe to be relevant and will fit the needs of the board. We're also looking at providing a yearly educational budget of $5,000 per board member per year. And it's when I took a look at what the different courses are and factoring in travel, all that sort of thing, $5,000 a year is what I believe to be a sufficient amount for each board member for each year. And additionally, there's also some state-mandated education that board members as well as staff need to take. So try to encapsulate that all within the education policy, and I'm looking for approval to adopt the board education policy as presented. Are there any questions?
This board education policy is one of many that we will include in our board governance document that hopefully we'll have over the next few months.
That is correct, Chair Shinoy. We're taking a look at where the identified gaps were so that we can make sure that we have best practice in place with respect to all board governance issues.
All right. I like that the policy has been laid out clearly, and I like the options, and I certainly would appreciate the opportunity to get further educated on these topics. Any other comments from the board?
This is Stephen Buckley. I'd make a motion to adopt the board education policy as presented.
Second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any nays? All right, so moved then.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the next item on our agenda is the implementation of SB 1049, presented by Yvette and Jerome.
Good morning, Chair Shinoy, members of the board. For the record, Yvette Elledge-Rhodes, Deputy Director. So I am going to be reviewing item C4, Senate Bill 1049 implementation update. In our...
May I interrupt you for just a second?
Yes.
I'm not able to hear very clearly. Is it possible for you to raise the volume on your...
Oh. I'll speak. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So, are you able to hear me now? I'm wondering if my mic does not work.
No, I think this is much better.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Great. Okay, so lots has happened since I actually drafted the board memo, so I'll be updating certain things in the memo that we have going on. At the project or at the program level, the entire program still remains yellow in health, mainly because we still have two projects. Their schedules have not yet been baselined. That's salary limits and member choice. We are close to baselining the salary limits schedule. I will be going through each project now and telling you what's going on with each one of those. For employer programs, happy that we adopted the EIF rule that was extending the payments for employers. That was one of the items that was actually impacting the health of the project. That project is now red, and so we have some EIF funding uncertainties. But we also are still waiting for the employer rate projection tool from CalPERS. I have heard that it is on, maybe on its way back to Oregon. So that will impact our schedule. And once we have analyzed the tool itself and determined how we can integrate it into our system, we will look at the schedule and determine what the new deliverable dates will be. And that is why it's red. For the salary limit project, the health of that project is still yellow, mainly because it has not been baselined. However, we have sent the project charter, the schedule, and the change request to the EIS, our oversight that will approve that. And hopefully we will get back into the green. They are in making great progress on the development of Work Package 3, which should be deployed on October 22nd. For the Work After Retirement project, that project remains in the green. It is making, as well, great progress towards their deployment in October. They were actually able to bring in the end date of that project by 2 months. We do have a change request in development for an increase in the budget. We are realizing that we need some temporary resources in the fall to help alleviate the manual workload that we have to post employer records. So once our functionality is deployed, we will have an effort to post thousands of records in our system, and we'll need about 5 temporary resources to accommodate that. For the member redirect project, that is actually going very well as well. That project at the last board meeting was yellow. It is now in the green, and they are well on target to meet their June 18th deployment date. They're in user acceptance testing right now, and that has been going well as well. There is a change request in development for that project too, and it's regarding our online member system user interface. That user interface has not been, that's the portal that our members use to access their accounts, and they have, that UI has not been updated since its inception. There are things such as our information security policies that need to be updated, password management, username conventions, multi-factor authentication, cross-browser compatibility. For example, it only works on one browser right now and is not able to be compatible with mobile devices either. It also doesn't comply with the ADA. So we are looking at adding that scope of work into the member redirect project in a kind of a two-phase project where the minimum that we need for Senate Bill 1049 will get done concurrently with this project and shouldn't be impacting the deliverables and schedule of member redirect. And then there's a phase two that we can do later. And that is a change to the budget as well. The other portion of member redirect, voluntary contributions, the release dates for those for that effort is continues to be refined. We have a September 30th release date for the majority of the functionality, which includes the members electing voluntary contributions through our online member system. And hopefully we're trying to weave in there the employers, the functionality for us to be invoicing employers at that time. Originally, we thought it was going to be done deployed separately in November, but now we're hoping that it can all be done at the same time. And that project also, Member Redirect also has another sub-project regarding the Employee Pension Stability Account ID, which is just something we are managing separately as a sub-project. And then the last project is member choice. At the last board meeting, that project was yellow. It is now green. And we have been moving fairly well in that progress. They actually have been also have a change request in process, and that is to remove the last work package, which we determined was not critical for Senate Bill 1049 and can be included in any future modernization that we do. It would have been nice to have it, but it really wasn't critical. So that will actually bring in, as they develop their schedule, that will bring in the project end date quite a bit. Any questions before I move on to our other activities on specific projects? Okay, so
I have,
go ahead.
In fact, I have a general question about the resources.
Uh-huh.
But I'm looking down at that bullet and it says projects are fully staffed and yet the recruitment is ongoing. So I assume it's because you've pulled people out of their regular posts and put them on 1049 implementation that you're backfilling now. Can you shed a little bit of light on that?
Sure, sure. So Chair Shenoy, members of the board, we have divided up, we got 43 staff or limited duration staff for, and some permanent, for Senate Bill 1049. We had a small group, I think it was 8, that were critical for the project, meaning they were full-time on the project, and they have all been filled. However, on Friday, last week, we had someone resign. So now we actually do have one vacancy for those critical roles. The remaining FTE that we had funded for the project were either in a backfill workload, backfill or workload category. And when I say backfill, it means all of the staff, the subject matter experts that we have pulled into the project have backfills doing their operational work to make sure that that work continues as planned. Or we hired them for workload. When I say workload, that means we needed another person in the mailroom because we were going to be getting additional mail or something like that. We had positions like that in our human resources with the increase in recruitments, another procurement specialist because of our increase in the number of contracts we're managing right now. So that is the rest of those positions that we're talking about. And we still have about 8 to 10 vacancies on the operational side in those workload or backfills. And it's a lot. I did a little analysis on when we went through and hired a bunch of these positions, how many were external recruitments versus internal hires, and it was almost 50-50. So with the movement of staff internally, that caused other vacancies. So that is one reason why we still have 10 vacancies. Did I answer your question?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
So going back up to the other program project activities, we did, on the independent quality management activities, we received our quarterly assessment in mid-May from Gartner, which is our second assessment from them. And I'm happy to say there was only one red item, and that was regarding our organizational change management activities. We did have some yellows, and we are addressing those. We have incorporated all of their recommendations into our action logs so we can track them and mitigate them as needed. As I noted in my memo, we do have the majority of the program and project staff telecommuting. They have been creative in how we resolve some of the communication issues. I think initially we, you know, felt that was a big challenge, but I think they've gotten through that and we're making good progress. We also turned in on May 15th our major IT project report that we will be doing quarterly to the Enterprise Information Services. And that's just something that is required of all major IT projects at the state level. There has been not a lot of movement on StageGate process. We had received the conditional StageGate 3 approval for member redirect. Member choice is still at the StageGate 2, but they're working towards 3. And for budget, we are continuing our monthly meetings with the Chief Financial Office, Legislative Fiscal Office, and the Governor's Office. Actually just had a meeting last Wednesday, and we reviewed our LFO recommendations and showed how they crosswalked into our action items and risk logs so we could, again, track all of those. We also were asked to provide a report on technical debt and the impact to that, to Senate Bill 1049, whether it was being resolved through 1049 or if it would be resolved at a later time, and actually got a lot of good feedback on that document as well. We continue to develop a budget request for the 2021-2023 biennium for Senate Bill 1049. Member redirect will be the only project that crosses the biennium, and it may, you know, we may need 6 to 8 more months of budget in order to complete that project. So we're trying to determine the long-term plan for member redirect at that time. We're also reviewing our budget allocations based on the policy option packages that were approved by the legislature, what we call POPs. And there are a couple of big items that may impact our allocations. So we'll be working with LFO and CFO to make sure we have those in the right, that they're, number one, aware of the moving of the allocations, and that they are also approving them. One of the big ones is that we are bringing in additional resources from Deloitte. There's at least three gentlemen that will be joining us next week. They will be joining us for about 3 months. There are three different things that they're going to be providing, is helping us at the program level with our quality assurance and testing coordination, and with some of our development coordination activities with releases and that sort of thing. So, but they're also going to be bringing in resources to help us with organizational change management, which is one of the big things that we've been, which has come through the Gartner quarterly assessment reports. They're also going to be looking at how we can build our project schedule based on effort versus timelines. Our schedules at this time, because we didn't have a lot of time ahead of this to really build an effort-driven schedule versus a time-based schedule. So they will be doing that concurrently over the next 8 weeks. So we're really excited to have them helping us, because that bringing some of their expertise and experience to help us mature the organization in some of these areas that are critical to the project. So that three-month effort is it's in a not-to-exceed contract of $1 million, which is incorporated into our budget. It's just not in the right allocations per se. So we'll be reviewing that with our analyst. The other big item is that we're realizing our infrastructure may need additional resources on the technology side, in servers and disk space and that sort of thing. As we're running all of these projects concurrently, we have multiple test environments, and Jordan is and his staff are realizing that we have hit our capacity and will need additional infrastructure space. So that is also another budgetary impact that we are trying to refine and will be bringing to our CFO to talk about. Any questions about budget before I move on, or any of the other items that I reported on?
This is Sadhana. The monthly meetings that you have with the CFO and the LFO and the governor's office, are they in the habit of providing feedback right there, or do they do some monthly or quarterly reports to you in terms of their thought process on how this work is moving along?
We are fortunate in that we get real-time feedback. We send quite a large packet out ahead of time with our monthly status report, the roadmap, and we walk through every, similar to what I'm doing today, we walk through every project and talk about these things. So we are able to get real-time feedback. I think they also follow up with questions later on when it occurs to them, because they also have access to all of the project information in the state PPM tool. I mean, they can go look at that at any time. So they also get the Gartner quarterly assessments. So there's a lot of information at their fingertips, and they're able to give us feedback at any time. So that's
very helpful, I'm sure, to you.
Yes. Yes, it is. No surprises. That's what everybody wants, is no surprises.
Good.
Any other questions? I'll move on just about communications, because I think that's another big area that we're working on. So for communications, I wanted to quickly talk about internally, we continue to make sure we have an intranet site for our staff, and we're trying to make sure our staff are continually updated with all of the progress on the projects. I think we've been spending the majority of our time developing new and enhanced external communications, because these things can be so complex. So, you know, we've been pretty fortunate to, as I said, we had a great webmaster on staff, and we'll be recruiting for a new one soon. But our building up our communications team has been probably the best thing we could have done as an agency to really make sure that our publications are professional and clear to understand. So in May, we sent out all of our annual statements. In the annual statement, we had a flyer. On one side, it was all about member redirect, and on the other side, it was all about member choice. And I'm happy to say that our call center manager and reported out that, yes, they got an increase in calls. They've been getting an increase in calls throughout the month of May due to our statements mailing. But we haven't been receiving a lot of questions about any of the legislation. We have produced 3 new videos that are on our website and that are really great and very simple to understand, so that, you know, members can really understand, number one, what is the individual account program and how does Senate Bill 1049 impact them. And we've gotten about 4,000 views on those so far. So that's really good news. But so on the member side, I feel like we are doing a lot and making sure the information is available in a lot of different areas, not only on our website, but in their annual statement and through the videos, a lot of different medias. We're also partnering with our employer advisory group with voluntary contributions. The delay in the actual ability for a member to elect, we are trying to make sure that the employer advisory group is giving us feedback on the quality and clarity of our communications about voluntary contributions. So they are in the process of reviewing that timeline and a process map that we're going to be sending out to employers, hopefully by the end of next week, in our June employer newsletter. So this will give them a lot more information about voluntary contributions. We'll also be updating our website at the same time. On the member side for voluntary contributions, we will probably be sending out something via our Gov delivery system to members, as well as updating our website in the fall when members are able to even elect. Through our online member system, they'll also be able to get some information, because that is where they will be doing the election. We had a change because of Senate Bill 1049 to our OPSERP withdrawals, so we included something on our webpage to clarify those changes as well. And then, as you saw today, we had some rules that we needed to be adopted. Regarding member choice, member redirect, voluntary contributions, and the EIF that have all been done. We've also recently collaborated with the Oregon State Treasury on their Invested For You newsletter, And that's because with the target date funds, you know, PERS is not PERS the agency is not the expert in investments, and we want to make sure our members are getting the best information regarding the member choice. Any questions on communications? And so
I looked at the agenda for the last board meeting, and you've listed out the internal communication activities. So I think rounding that up and providing details on the external communications is perfect. It gives us a good range of everything that you've been doing in this area. So thank you.
You're welcome. One last thing, actually a couple last things. I think we've already been talking about some of the employer concerns that we have had regarding the delay in voluntary contributions. So I attached, or on the last page of my board memo, I kind of summarized that, and Stephanie addressed it as well in her presentation. We are trying to make sure that employers are getting information as quickly as possible, and have tried to alleviate their concerns as much as possible if they did want to start deducting voluntary contributions after July 1. They are welcome to do that, so we're going to be giving them some guidelines, that things that they need to be thinking about regarding that. But ultimately, in September or October 1, when members are allowed to elect, we're hoping that the functionality to be invoicing employers is beginning at that same time. Any questions about the employer concerns? I'd also like to address Mr. Mundeden's letter about salary limits that we attached to the board packet.
Please do so. Before you go there, I think just I want to mention that with legislation as complicated as 1049, it definitely lends itself to many, many different interpretations. So, this is one of those, and I appreciate everybody's effort in trying to resolve some of these. So yes. Please go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Shenoy. This member actually contacted me earlier in the year, and I had run his questions through our policy and compliance section about salary limits. Unfortunately, when salary limits, when we started looking at the impact, which populations this part of the bill applied to, we focused a lot on the members that made $195,000 per calendar year. And the proration side of the bill, which states or applies to members that terminate in the middle of the year or in some part of the calendar year but don't work the full year, is the more complicated side of Senate Bill 1049, salary limit provision. And so we did address that probably later than we should have. However, the way we've interpreted it is very similar to how we apply it to our OPSERP program. And so this isn't new for us at all, but it does adversely impact members that retire particularly early in the calendar year and make more than $16,000 or so a month. And so in his case, the state pays. This happens every year. We only do get 12 payments a year, but we get the December payment paid January 1 in January, and then we also sometimes, depending on when February falls, we get the January check, perhaps in January. So you could have two payments in 1 month. And for some people, that could push them over the prorated salary limit. I think the misconception is that this only applies to people that make over $195,000, and in fact, it can impact members that do make less than that, but whose monthly prorated salary reaches the limits that we've set forth. So we basically just took $195,000 and divided it by 12. And so the farther you work in the year, say you retire November 1, you may not have an issue at all because that limit is much higher. So are there any questions about the letter that we've sent or salary limits?
This is Stephen Buckley. Is the prorating of the $195,000 statutory or a policy decision?
That is statutory. It actually tells us, the statute actually instructs us to do that. Are there any other questions about what I've reported today? Okay, well, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Okay. We should take a virtual tea break for 5 seconds and then move on to the agency budget development. Invite Richard Horsford to present that item.
Good morning, Chair Shinoy, members of the board. For the record, Richard Horsford, Chief Financial Officer. Today, we're presenting an update on the 21-23 budget development. We continue to refine our concepts for the upcoming biennium's budget. If you recall, we had presented some thoughts on where we were at the March board meeting. As we've refined those policy option packages, we've removed about $1.9 million of potential requests from that March report. So what you have in the packet today has a total of $4.4 million in requests. And this is a result of our efforts understanding the current climate and looking deeper into each of our requests to see where we might accomplish some of the goals in a different way or where some of the things that we're doing may have offsetting cost savings. So what we have here is a little closer. As Yvette had mentioned previously, this does not include a request for any 1049 work that may not be completed. At this point, our working assumption is that the overall 1049 budget that was provided in the current biennium is probably enough to complete everything, but the timeline may not be realistic. So the net effect is that the funds authorized in the current biennium probably won't be completely spent, but instead we will be putting a proposal forward for the next biennium to ask for funding to finish those up. But our hope is that when you look at the project as a whole over two biennium, it will still be within the same magnitude as an overall project. But as we get the details refined, we will share with the board what portion we think will roll into the next biennium. Looking at some of the details on summary, we have a number of things like adding some facilities staffing to address a known shortage that's caused significant challenges, upgrading some of our communications section support, adding a position in information services to upward and reclass positions. So there's a number of things within IT that we really need to bump the positions up to recognize the work that they are doing. And of course, the modernization process, which has been an ongoing effort and has been identified across the board as a challenge that needs to be addressed. Within operations, we're looking at adding some education team enhancements, death unit staffing, addressing some areas that have really accumulated significant backlogs, and getting some work with the qualifying, non-qualifying data. In compliance and risk, we do have an enterprise risk management position. This goes hand in hand with some of the enterprise risk management projects that have been ongoing. This is the next logical step of that going forward. And then with that information security and continuity program, which, again, takes the efforts on security and risk management that have occurred in the current biennium and extends them to the next logical steps. With that said, I will take a second and see if there are any thoughts or questions on our overall approach and proposals for the budget.
No, I think we are good. So just one question I have is that you have reduced the budget by removing about $2 million from the initial request, and this is in anticipation of reductions. How are you going to approach these before you present the budget finally to LFO? Are you going to assume that these reductions will be asked of you, or is this just an internal exercise?
Well, and so when we say reduction, this is reducing the ask. So we're still looking at asking for additional funds in the coming biennium above what was in the current biennium, but asking for notably less. Our first pass, we were looking at adding significantly more to the package, but considering the challenges, we've pared that back. But this does still ask for money. I think the part of the reasoning and logic of still asking for more is there are a number of areas that have been identified that need attention, and a number of these areas we were making progress toward before the onset of Senate Bill 1049. So some of these may have already been asked for had it not been for 1049, and our partners at LFO and CFO are well aware and on board, at least conceptually, in where there are challenges and where these investments are necessary. But I think going back to the question of reductions, that is a concept that we know is possible. As Director Olenek mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, so far PERS, being a other funded agency, hasn't been asked to make cuts, but we recognize that in the current environment that could be possible. At the same time, the competing interest is there are items that we really do need to tend to make sure that we can continue to serve our members at the standard that we have set and expect to be able to.
Okay. All right. Any other questions from the board? Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. The next item is continuing the discussion on rate collaring. And I would invite the Milliman team to join us.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. This is Matt Larrabee with Milliman in Portland. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
So, Matt, I was thinking of trying a slightly different approach to today's presentation. Typically, we let you go through your presentation, and then board will come up and ask questions of you, but since this was a letter that you have presented to us, we've read the letter. It is excellently written and presents the items that the board had asked for in the March meeting. But I would invite board members to just generally ask their questions before, so that as you go through the items, you can address them. So, and I certainly have 3 points that I would like to bring up. Does that sound reasonable to you?
Absolutely, that sounds fantastic.
Would the board like to present their questions right now? Just thoughts. It doesn't have to be a specific question, but anything that you might require answers for.
Chair Shenoy, this is Lawrence Fernstall. I thought the memo was very, very helpful, and I particularly was taken by the conceptual ability, the ability and concept of the collaring approach to deal not just with investment return volatility, but with volatility in the assumptions that the board makes as part of rate setting, and legislative actions, and then judicial review that could overturn those actions in a kind of complicated way. So with that, I'm wondering sort of two questions. One is, as a matter of comparison, could you go backward to some of the things that have happened in that category, such as the Morrow decision, for example, the legislation as reversal to the Morrow decision, and show what would happen if we had used an asset smoothing method as opposed to a collaring method? And then secondly, going forward, as I understand the Monte Carlo simulations you provide us as part of the rate setting process, you include within that the impact of the collaring methodology for each of the 10,000 runs, et cetera, you do. And I'm wondering if you could run those also, what would it look like prospectively in a Monte Carlo simulation if we use a asset smoothing method instead?
Sure. Board Member Fernstall, I will answer those. I think there's kind of two separate questions there, and I will I'll do my best to re-articulate each of them, and then answer them, and then quite possibly ask Scott Reppernow to weigh in as well with his perspective on this. As far as the kind of the backward looking, the back testing analysis question, how things might have been different if we were using the traditional input smoothing approach with the asset collaring. It would be a very challenging analysis and somewhat speculative analysis for us to try to conduct. And the reason I say that relates to the kind of the pros and cons of each of the broad approaches, input and asset smoothing, as we articulated in our letter. Given that the court, you know, the legislative and court decisions and assumption changes are not readily addressed in an input smoothing approach, trying to quantify what rates might have looked like under those scenarios would have us require us to make assumptions about what the board's policy responses would have been, and they likely would have been ad hoc policy responses in reaction to the legislative changes, and then in particular to the court decision, which came, as I recall, about 18 to 24 months after the legislative changes. So that one's a difficult one to for us to kind of do one of our traditional looking studies with all sort of numbers and charts and figures and say this is where we would be, but for, you know, the policy decision that was made, because it requires the introduction of several presumptions which we would not be, you know, well positioned to know how the board would have asked us to accommodate and respond to those sources of volatility. On the forward-looking question, this is a really good one, and as we were writing the letter and then in discussions with Director Olenek in preparation for today's meetings, We were able very recently to unearth the presentations that were made to the PERS board when rate collaring was initially adopted as a concept, output smoothing. This was done over a almost a 12-month process, multiple meetings during the latter part of 2005 and the earlier half of 2006. And I was very, very pleased to report to the board, and we can share the material if interested and informative, that unsurprisingly, when this was put in, it was put in as part of the financial modeling process and the traditional asset smoothing approach and the rate collar structure were tested side by side using that Monte Carlo simulation, the 10,000 future scenarios of variable year-to-year investment return. And I think that that study gave the board a significant amount of comfort in the approach because it indicated that in that particular realm of volatility sources, one specific source, actual future investment return volatility, that the rate collar structure handled that in an extremely similar manner to a traditional asset smoothing method. And if the board ended up being interested in having us as part of the financial modeling this upcoming December, of reopening that discussion and reopening that analysis, we would intend to have a similar type of structure to what was done with initial implementation back in 2005 and 2006. Scott, I don't know, Scott, you probably should identify yourself, I suppose, since I'm just talking, but do you have any other comments or thoughts in response to Lawrence's question?
Sure, and for the record, this is Scott Prepernon with Milliman. So quick comment on both of those points. So the first sort of, you know, how a Morrow decision or similar large impact event that isn't kind of readily handled in the input smoothing, you know, asset smoothing approach. It is, you know, hard to say what would have happened precisely, but there would have had to be a conversation on if such a full change would come through kind of all in one step or somehow get, you know, handled and smoothed kind of ad hoc. For a reference point on this, we've certainly seen this with other systems and even PERS, and this is before the time of Matt and I were working with the system, but after the dot-com kind of events and downturn in the market and other things going on, there was an ad hoc decision to my memory of delaying a calculated increase in the rates and spreading it over to biennial. And so in some ways, that kind of ad hoc decision can be a rate caller that just has to be worked out kind of on the fly rather than having it in place in advance, and we've seen that in other systems, other, you know, state systems or large systems that don't kind of have this framework. So while we don't know exactly what would happen for Morrow or anything else, those kind of discussions are pretty common in that situation. And then, yeah, we'll just echo the point on the financial modeling. You can certainly go back and kind of update that analysis. But the conclusions from before were certainly that in sort of the, you know, the asset only space that you see in running those, you know, say 10,000 scenarios, the collaring and the asset smoothing do a pretty similar job of handling that kind of volatility. And then it's really the, you know, the non-asset, kind of volatility that the rate collaring gives you a framework to deal with, but the asset smoothing, you know, doesn't and instead requires, kind of off-cycle analysis.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I have one question to add to the two questions that that Director Fernstall asked of you, and that is that, as you've mentioned in your letter, volatility can come from a variety of sources. Updates to investment return, that's one, but I feel like Oregon PERS might be a little bit more sensitive to legislative actions as well as judicial decisions that follow those legislative actions. So how could we, or is there a way to perform some sort of sensitivity analysis that almost rates and ranks these volatility events as inputs? So that would be, and you don't necessarily have to answer that question right now, but as you are going through your presentation, that would be one thing I would be curious about.
So, Chair Shinoy, this is Matt Larrabee. In terms of Oregon PERS's sensitivity to a given volatility event. Thinking, for example, of the investment return space. So, you know, obviously investment returns this year, not great so far. It's been a while since we've done it. I believe that we have not done this one particular exercise for any of the current five members of the board, but we have in times past benchmarked Oregon PERS's sensitivity to those sorts of volatility events, be them on the assumption side or the actual investment results against other peer systems. And the results of those of that testing and those demonstrations are that your sense is right, that Oregon PERS is more sensitive to any given that sort of event in those areas. Actual investment return deviating from assumption or a change in assumption. The reason for that comes down to the size of Oregon PERS on the investment return space, the size of Oregon PERS's assets relative to its payroll. So, you know, a given level of investment return in the market is percentage-wise how it's going to get expressed in rates for peer systems is going to depend on how much of an asset loss or gain there was in dollar terms relative to the size of the system's payroll. In that dimension, Oregon PERS is a quite large system. It has a high ratio of assets over payroll compared to almost all of the other peers that it has in the country. So for a given level of deviation in actual investment returns, that's going to express itself as a larger percentage of payroll rate change as being necessary in the actuarially calculated contribution rates. The same sort of rule of thumb, ratio type of thing, applies on the assumption side as well. Oregon PERS is not alone in having lowered its investment return assumptions several times over the past decade. Those assumption changes, when they occur, how much that will change the employer's rate depends on how large the liabilities of the system are as the numerator of a fraction compared to its payroll. And again, in this area, for a variety of reasons, Oregon PERS has kind of a higher leverage or volatility ratio compared to other systems. So when, for example, you know, when we have a decrease in the investment return assumption comparing to a peer system, I think an Oregon PERS employer or a finance officer could look at this and say, I don't understand why my contribution rate changes so much more than the system I'm looking at in a peer state. And that's the reason for it, is that and some of this is due to history. Some of it is just due to demographics. But the liabilities that we have in the system are a higher multiple of the payroll compared to some other state systems that we see. Scott, I don't know if you have anything you want to add to that.
Nope, I think that covers it.
Okay, great. Do any of the board members have any other questions before we let Matt and Scott go through their letter? All right, it's all yours, Matt.
Okay, I will, I think what I was going to say has mostly been answered, and so well, it's not going to be like Tiger King or Last Dance level entertainment, but I'll take about maybe 3 or 4 minutes and talk through the letter here. So, you know, our letter here, you know, we are comparing, you know, the two broadly available approaches in actuarial contribution rate calculations: input smoothing, which is currently used by most systems, and output smoothing, which has been used by PERS for the past decade and a half or so, and we refer to as the rate collar mechanism. Smoothing mechanisms are really used to manage volatility, particularly in the area of UAL, or unfunded actuarial liability, in development of contribution rates. These mechanisms are universally used by systems, and their use is warranted given the long time horizon nature of both system funding and the payment of system benefits. As we've already discussed earlier with the question and answer section is covered in the letter, volatility can come from a wide variety of sources, and this is fully evident from the past decade for Oregon PERS. Actual investment returns varying from assumption and being volatile from year to year is a very plainly evident and certain source of volatility both in the past and in the future. We can also have volatility in the UAL from legislative actions and from judicial actions. Those are hard to predict in terms of both magnitude and timing. And then two sources that are more wonky and subtle but can still be quite important and are very evident to the board and other interested parties are related to assumptions. important, most notably the investment return assumption and the life expectancy or mortality assumption for retirees. In the letter, we talk about the input use smoothing approach, which is used by the majority of systems. For those that are visual learners, we've got an attachment A that kind of graphically depicts the process there. We identify four possible inputs to the actuarial liability and rate calculations, which can be smoothed by systems that use these approaches. The most prominent and widely used input smoothing technique can be done in a best practice manner. This is referred to as asset smoothing. It's really systematically over a period of multiple years recognizing actual investment returns rather than recognizing them all at once in a single year in the actuarial calculations. As we discussed in the letter, managing contribution rates by smoothing the other three inputs, which are the return assumption, the mortality assumption, and the UAL amortization period policy, those can be more problematic. And when some or all of those inputs are smooth, they're often performed in a manner that can vary from best practices in our experience. We note that in our letter that the input smoothing, a pro of that approach, one of the pros, is that it deals with actual investment return volatility, that source of volatility, it deals with it in a quite stable manner. It does have some disadvantages, however, the input smoothing method, including the difficulty of dealing with these other sources of volatility, which we've seen with Oregon PERS and other systems have seen. And also, it has an inability for employers to know their projected future contribution rates or the range of possible rates as quickly as we are able to do that with the output smoothing approach. Turning to output smoothing, this is an approach that's been used called the rate collar by PERS for the last 15 years or so. We don't smooth, and this is noted in attachment B of our letter, we don't smooth any of the four inputs that we discuss in the input smoothing as possible options. Instead, we used unsmoothed outputs, prudent assumptions, and best practice amortization policy lengths to calculate an unsmooth contribution rate, which we refer to as the uncollared rate. That uncollared rate is an output of our actuarial calculations, and it's based on unsmoothed inputs. Only at that point, after developing the uncollared rate, do we use a smoothing technique, which we refer to as a rate collar. When the uncollared rate is close enough to the current contribution rate, there is no smoothing applied to the output. If, however, the difference between the uncollared rate that we develop and the current contribution rate is large, the output smoothing technique, i.e. the rate collar, systematically spreads that contribution rate increase over several biennia. It will not come as a surprise to any of the board members that we continue to think the output smoothing method has advantages, and we note those in the letter. As I discussed in response to a question I believe that Board Member Fernstall posed, when output smoothing was originally adopted by the board, it was done over multiple meetings back in 2005 and 2006 with board feedback along the way. And importantly, as I noted in my answer to the question that Board Member Fernstall posed, that was stress tested using the Monte Carlo approach side by side with the asset smoothing, input smoothing approach, and was viewed by the board at that time as its equal in terms of being able to deal with volatility in that one particular dimension. So, you know, this item today is on the agenda. It's an information and feedback item. It's not an action item. So you've already asked some questions, but we would like to solicit the board's feedback. Since both smoothing approaches are designed to address unforeseen future volatility, the natural time for us as the system actuaries to analyze and compare possible approaches and possible policies is the financial modeling work, which we present at the December board meeting each year. We can model several possible specific approaches for consideration. If we do that work, an important piece of feedback is if we should develop policy alternatives that remain within the broad category of output smoothing and rate collaring. An example of this might be adjustments to the formula that determine the width of the collar for an experience sharing rate pool. Alternatively, we could also model policy package alternatives that would fall into the category of input smoothing. Given that the normal course timing for financial modeling is the December meeting, we don't need any specific board direction today to be able to model specific policy alternatives. But any directional feedback today or prior to the next board meeting would be welcome to let us focus our policy development efforts in a direction preferred by the board. So with that, I'd like to thank everybody for your attention and to hand it back to you, Chair Shenoy, to get feedback, discussion, and any additional questions from the board.
Thank you, Matt. Put it to my fellow members. Any questions, any comments?
This is Stephen Buckley. I thought of this as kind of a two-part process. The first part was the memo that Milliman put out today analyzing the input and the output smoothing approaches. I think what would be beneficial for the next meeting would be for Milliman to focus on the rate collaring methodology, perhaps starting out with a review of the rate collaring methodology that's been in effect for 14 or 15 years, and then perhaps provide some videos and maybe even recommendations on the rate collaring formula. You know, should there perhaps be a third collar? Should the percentage increase or decrease in employer contributions be greater than the collar that's currently placed based on our current policy? In other words, should the rate, if the board decides that the output smoothing approach is the best approach, are there changes that might be beneficial to the rate collaring formula that's currently in effect? With the goal, of course, of making sure that the plan is being adequately funded.
I think board
of both legislative changes and perhaps significant increases or decreases in investments above the assumed rate of return.
Board Member Buckley, this is Matt Larrabee. I think that those are all avenues that we can explore and continue the discussion and the analysis leading up to December in advance of the next board meeting. And I do think, and we've alluded to this, maybe not as much in the memo that we prepared for this meeting, but in some of the material that we prepared for the prior meeting, that the rate collar, the broad structure of the rate collar was developed 15 years ago, and there have been a lot of significant changes in the system in the last 15 years. Notable among those is that the base contribution rates right now, because of a confluence of events, lower investment return assumption, court decisions, a higher, longer life expectancy assumption, the contribution rates are higher now than they were, and so we do think it would be an appropriate time to look at policy alternatives inside the family of the output smoothing approaches, and there will be trade-offs. I don't think there's ever any one clear approach, but we want to give the board a clear-eyed analytical view of the trade-offs, the pros and cons of a particular policy alternative versus another alternative inside of alternative variations of the collaring formula as the board tries to follow its mission of balancing those competing objectives of protecting benefits, contribution, and predictable stable rates, but also, improving funded status.
Yeah, I think that sounds like an excellent idea for next time. I think I, for one, would also really like to see the presentations you made 15 years ago, because that would be easy for this board to also take a look at and try to understand the rationale behind the rate collaring mechanism that was adopted in 2005-06. So I would love to take a look at those presentations since you've unearthed them.
Chair Schindler, we would be happy to share those, and I hope that you will find them to be just as exciting and compelling as actual presentations that you've seen as chair.
Yes, for sure. Anything else on this topic? Okay. Director Olenek is a foot. Thank you again, Matt and Scott, for the very thoughtful letter, and as always, for your good advice and your good perspective. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Director Olenek, is there anything else that we need to address?
Chair Chinoy, no, I don't believe there's anything left on the agenda or any other topics to discuss at this time.
Do the board members have anything else that they would like to talk about?
Not this time.
All right. Okay, wonderful. Thank you then. We will meet again at the supplementary June board meeting. Until then, thank you everyone, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Chinoy. Bye everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.